This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota. This morning, our show will include two conversations from the past week. One with Shelley Peterson, president of the North Dakota Long-Term Care Association. Nursing home residents are among the most vulnerable populations for the novel coronavirus pandemic. And we'll hear from Cliff Newmark, the chief of marketing for Vitalant, one of the nation's largest blood banks. He talks about the challenge to maintain blood donations during the pandemic and the promise of one donor product, convalescent plasma, to help COVID patients. First, we'll get a news update from our news director, Dave Thompson.
Governor Doug Burgum says he's feeling positive and optimistic about the state of the COVID-19 pandemic in North Dakota, but he's also urging vigilance against the virus. At his now weekly COVID-19 briefing, Burgum said testing remains high and positive rates have held steady and low for several weeks now. But he also says potential still exists for hotspots to emerge, even in areas that have not had much coronavirus activity. He says one example of that is Arkansas, which had lower contraction rates throughout the pandemic. It recently reported over 700 new cases in a weekend, linked to a correctional facility and a poultry processing plant.
We talked about this early, that when uncontained, if you're not doing testing, you're not doing isolation, if you've got rapid spread, this disease, which is potentially two times more contagious than the flu, can spread really rapidly. So there are places in the U.S. right now, as we sit here in this comfortable spot in North Dakota, where they're seeing exponential spread.
Burgum says as North Dakota continues to reopen its economy and loosen guidelines on gatherings, residents need to be mindful and practice physical distancing and proper hand hygiene to continue to mitigate the spread throughout the summer. Advocates for residents of long-term care facilities have been asking state officials to tweak some of the provisions outlined in the plan to allow more family visitation as well as social gatherings inside the facilities. Those were restricted because of the coronavirus. Most of the facilities in North Dakota are in phase one of the reopening plan, meaning family members can make outside visits to residents. North Dakota Long-Term Care Association Executive Director Shelley Peterson says one tweak that was implemented is that during phase two, residents will be able to sit forward a dining table with tables 6 feet apart.
Because they haven't seen their table mates that they used to eat with each day, and they're in their rooms. And being in a room for 90 days has been difficult, even though there's been a lot of virtual visitation and doorway bingo and other activities.
Peterson says families also want the opportunity to hug their loved ones who are in a facility if they are wearing protective gear.
It has been really, really hard to have families see each other for the first time in 90 days and not want to hug them. We know there's some hugs that people are sneaking in, and rightly so.
State Human Services Director Chris Jones says a task force is looking at that issue.
We don't have a definitive answer yet on when we can begin to hug, but we do recognize that it's extremely important.
Governor Burgum announced a pilot project at a Bismarck facility. He says at Augusta Place, if family members are tested for COVID and are negative, they will be allowed to have a scheduled indoor visitation for a period of 1 week following that negative test. Burgum says it mirrors workers in those facilities who are tested weekly.
We realize that there still is risk because you can test negative on a Monday, and you could be exposed on a Tuesday or Wednesday and have COVID and then go visit a loved one on a Thursday or Friday. And we understand there's risk here, but we're bringing the risk down for family members with this trial testing to the same rate of risk that we are when we have healthcare workers entering the facilities.
Meanwhile, long-term care facilities have had to turn to technology to facilitate online visits between residents and families because of restricted visitation due to COVID-19. And they say it has yielded some unexpected benefits. Dawn Hummel is a senior executive of resident care for Bethany Retirement Living of Fargo. She says she has been talking with a family member about how tough things have been because of restrictions on visitors.
And then she said, you know, for us, it's actually been a positive. I've got family members that live all over the United States. We've had more connections through this COVID pandemic with my mom than we've ever had as ever. And so I think, I mean, that is a plus where you're connecting many people with our elderly who we all love dearly. So I just think that that is a huge plus. But the reality of it is when you can connect people through technology, that's a pretty cool thing.
This upcoming Tuesday has been designated Silver Lining Day in North Dakota. The North Dakota Long-Term Care Association said it's to celebrate the 15,000 workers at North Dakota's 218 long-term care facilities. The association says the employees have worked to keep COVID-19 out of the facilities and say those employees have been working long hours and sacrificed a lot in the process. Cynthia Treadwell is administrator of the Hatton Prairie Village.
I hear this over and over. I don't want to be the one to bring the virus into our facility. And we have not had the virus in Hatton Prairie Village. We have not furloughed any employees. We've not reduced hours or salaries, nor have we lost any employees. There is this sense of coming together, and we are going to fight this pandemic. And we are going to come out strong on the other side and be there for our residents and our families.
A group of Democratic state lawmakers is calling for a special legislative session. The group says a session would deal with how to spend the $1.25 billion the state has received from the Federal CARES Act to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. Fargo Senator Tim Mathern says spending the money is left in the hands of the state's Emergency Commission, whose decisions are reviewed by the legislature's budget section.
This leaves 14 districts without any representation in this complicated matter. Citizens deserve to be involved in how we allocate this money.
The group is also suggesting the special session take up a $1 billion bonding bill for infrastructure. House Minority Leader Josh Boucher of Fargo said the Prairie Dog bill, which would provide money to cities, counties, and townships for infrastructure projects, may not be funded.
The bonding bill is a way for us to save cash, to use smart investments when interest rates are low, and to benefit our cities, our townships, and our counties. Not only that, but it'll boost great-paying jobs.
Meanwhile, the Senate Majority Leader said there's no need for a special legislative session at this point. Rich Wardner says Democratic leadership has been in on the discussions of the allocations of the CARES Act money.
You need to keep in mind that it's federal money, and most of it is earmarked. It has to be spent. I mean, it's got a timeline. It has to be spent by December 31 of 20.
And as for the billion-dollar bonding bill,
I think you got to have a little bit better picture of the economy before you jump into that. And I realize that money is cheap now, and bonding does make some sense. But I think we need to know a little more information about the economy before we make a decision to bond for $1 billion.
A special session can be called in two ways. Governor Burgum could call lawmakers back, and the legislature can call itself back. In the latter case, legislators must still hold to the 80-day limit on legislative days.
We only have 4 days. It would take more than 4 days to do what they're talking about, I believe.
For Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Most of the North Dakota deaths from COVID-19 involved the elderly, particularly those with underlying conditions. That pretty much describes the residents of nursing homes. And last week, we talked about the challenge of keeping them safe with Shelley Peterson, president of the North Dakota Long-Term Care Association.
The North Dakota Long-Term Care Association is a nonprofit organization. We represent over 200 basic care, assisted living, and nursing facility members. And really our focus and mission is to assist facilities so they can provide outstanding care to North Dakotans who need long-term care. Probably our primary function is education, information. There are so many issues impacting long-term care, so we really try to keep our members in the loop on state regulations, federal regulations, standards of practice, as well then the second function is lobbying. Lobbying before state government, before the federal government on issues of importance to long-term care. Funding being a critical component of that.
I know that in April of 2019, you had a discussion about long-term care with our Ashley Thornburg, and at that point, you talked a great deal about the financial stresses that are currently facing your facilities, and we'll get into that. But I want to start, first of all, with the effect of the pandemic. What can you tell us about the effects of the outbreak on long-term facilities in North Dakota?
You know, what we're seeing and experiencing is something unprecedented, as you know, something that we've never gone through in the last 100 years. And so it has been challenging. It has been difficult. But in long-term care, facilities have absolutely stepped up to the plate, have done a phenomenal job, and are keeping residents safe. I think that was our number one priority. No one knew for sure how it would hit. As you said in your opening, the elderly at most at risk are at most risk, and those with underlying health conditions, and those represent the people that we care for. So our association, along with our national affiliate, came out really early in early March, recommending no visitation, no group dining, and really were at the forefront of saying we need to close down, we need to protect ourselves, we need to keep our communities closed and safe. And then the governor came out with an executive order about 3 weeks later. But I know, you know, the number one issue facing facilities and families right now is they want to see each other. And that has been hard. That has been tremendously hard on families. We're in the reopening process, but I know for some it can't be fast enough. I know for some they're really, really missing their family member in our facility. Some outdoor visits don't work because of the frail condition of the nursing home resident. So they're waiting anxiously for the, you know, for phase two, where we can have one-on-one visiting. Next Tuesday, June 23rd, we have what we're calling Silver Linings Day, and the governor just proclaimed it. And it's really to recognize the 16,000 people that are working every day in long-term care. You know, they haven't been furloughed. They've been picking up extra shifts. They're wearing protective equipment. They're taking extra measures to connect family members to their residents. They've done an outstanding job. And because of that, people have been safe. So we're facilities, though, are feeling the anxiety of families. We want to safely open up. You know, you hear those stories now in other states that they're having a resurgence of numbers. And oh my goodness, that would be frightening and that would be scary, and we don't want that to happen in North Dakota. So we're trying to find the balance, especially our residents.
In North Dakota, Cass County has been pretty much the nexus of the outbreak so far. It's been hardest hit, and in Cass County, most of the fatalities have involved people in nursing homes. And the same is true in Moorhead on the Minnesota side of the Red River. So this population is vulnerable. As you said, it seems to be quieting down a bit now. But if you do open up for visits, one other observation I've been making recently is that if I go into a business, the people who work there typically are wearing face masks and enforcing distancing issues. But the people who shop there more often than not are not. So if nursing homes do have people coming in to visit, will they require face masks and appropriate hygiene care?
Yes, absolutely. So that in the guidelines, you know, the first in phase one, and right now we have, I believe it's just a little over 150 out of the 218 are in phase one. In phase one, it's only outdoor visitation and it's scheduled. In phase two, then you can do one-on-one visits, but absolutely they'll need to wear, when families come in, face masks. And we're trying to get sufficient supplies because we're burning through a lot of gowns, face masks, and other protective equipment. So we're trying to see to make sure that we have sufficient supplies so that families don't bring a clean mask in, that we can provide it. But when they do come in, the expectation is the social distance of 6 feet, as well as the wearing of a mask. Now, that the issue on 6 feet has really been difficult, because if you haven't seen someone, your mother or your father, for 90 days, 100 days, not having a hug, families are saying this is so difficult. But, you know, we want to be safe.
You mentioned that you represent more than 200 facilities in the state of North Dakota, and that this phase two will involve about 30 of them. Can you characterize for us where they'll be? What qualifies you for phase two?
What qualifies you for phase two is, well, first in phase one, you have to have had two rounds of testing of all your staff and all your residents. And then you have to, and that all the residents have to come back negative. And then you can do the, you know, the outdoor visiting. What qualifies you for phase two is that you have to spend 14 days in phase one, an automatic 14 days. And then you have a third round of testing, and all the testing for residents needs to come back negative. So it's really tied to, you have to spend 14 days in each phase. So you have to spend 14 days in phase one, two rounds of testing, and you can do outdoor visitation. And then in phase two, you have to do another third round of testing. They all have to come back negative for residents, and then you can qualify for one-on-one scheduled visits. The third and final phase of testing then is a fourth round, you know, 2 weeks in phase two, and then another round, a fourth round of testing, again, with all negative COVID-19 testing of residents. So it comes back negative. And then what that will do is allow you to open up visitation more, so you don't have to schedule it. You can come into the facility, kind of the resumption of our new normal. We'll see how, you know, how people get through phase one and phase two, but we're excited at the prospect of, by the 4th of July, we will have some potentially in phase three. That's all made on the assumption, though, that their third and their fourth rounds of testing are coming back negative. The other thing that's exciting, at least for the Bismarck community in one facility, is Augusta Place. They're doing a pilot test there, and just as they're testing staff, they're testing visitors. And so all visitors that want to come in and visit their family member who take a COVID-19 test and get results that are negative, they're going to allow them to come in for during that week's period of time. They'd have to take another test if they want to continue. But we're seeing is, it, would it be helpful if we tested all visitors and we could open up visiting a little bit more? So we're excited to see how, you know, how that might play out and how that might help us to open up visiting more, or and especially as we look at the second, you know, wave that may or may not hit. Yeah, the other thing that might be kind of good, Doug, too, is in phase two, they've revised the guidance. The governor opened it up a little bit more, because what we were hearing from families is, if you could at least open up within the facility a little bit more, then people could have activities together as a group and they could eat together, because residents have been eating in their room. They've been socially isolated for one-on-one activities, or maybe bingo, where you're sitting in the hallway, but you're not able to see or hear very well. So now in phase two, what they're allowing with the revisions is that you could go to the dining room, and we could have four residents sitting at a dining room table together. And we've not had that since early March.
Well, this has been an expensive proposition for everybody. You know, there have been revenues lost for state governments. North Dakota is no different than most states. In the cost of long-term care, all this personal protective equipment, all of this testing, the time that staff has had to add to their working hours, you're already dealing with nonprofits mostly that are dealing with razor-thin margins. How has this affected the bottom line for long-term care in North Dakota?
Last week, a facility had shared with me they ordered some gowns, some isolation gowns, and they spent $400,000 on those gowns. Now, granted, it was a large facility, but they were spending an enormous amount on protective equipment, which we need and which we appreciate. We've had good access to it. All the testing has been free. Thank goodness. That helps immensely, because we're doing testing every week in facilities. The other thing, though, is we're spending, you know, we haven't furloughed any staff. We're asking staff to work overtime. We're bringing in contract staff when we don't have enough staff, because we have needed every single staff person, because it's been intense. Just the gearing up to put the protective equipment on takes extra time, so you need more staff because it's taking more time to do it properly. Having residents dine in their room and running the meals back and forth and doing individual activities so that they stay engaged, it's just been extremely expensive to do that. It's been necessary to do that, but expensive to do that. As we shared, we only have, I think, out of the 79 nursing facilities, all but two of them are nonprofit or governmental owned, community affiliated or church affiliated. They don't have much money. And what was absolutely wonderful is we went into this pandemic with the 2019 legislature. We talked with you a year ago. The 2019 legislature properly funded long-term care. We're blessed in the state. We have legislators that look at the data, look at the information, and they make good, right decisions. And what they did last session is they funded North Dakota so that we could properly staff our facilities and provide good, reasonable salary and benefits. North Dakota, at this point in time, when we look at our staffing, we're the highest staffed 4- and 5-star facilities in the United States. And so we're blessed with that. But what we've been doing is we've been spending more than what was allocated simply because we needed more staff to help gear up. We've had to do overtime. And so it's been expensive. Thank goodness the federal government came through in the payroll protection plan. If you had under 500 employees, many facilities applied for that. Our larger facilities were not able to apply or qualify for that, but the payroll protection plan helped immensely. And especially some of our very small rural facilities. The other thing that happened is 2 weeks ago, the nursing homes received a payment from the federal government. And that was, you know, our congressional delegation was instrumental in making sure nursing facilities got some money. Prior to that point, they had received tiny, tiny little disbursements based on their Medicare utilization. But finally, a disbursement came through specifically for nursing facilities. I think nationwide it was $5 billion in North Dakota. I don't have the exact number, but every facility got some money. It was based on a flat rate of $50,000 a facility, and then I believe it was $2,500 a licensed bed. That helped immensely. Now, what we're waiting for is state government to make a determination. We had a meeting with them a couple of weeks ago, and they said, you know what, we might just offset all that money that you just received, which means they're going to take it away. That would be truly devastating. Not taking away that you have to pay them the check back, but what they do is they would give you your rates and say, well, since you've got this other money from the federal government, we're going to subtract that from your rates. That's as though then you really, it didn't benefit us, it didn't help us. And right now, it's helping keep the doors open, it's helping pay our staff. And some facilities have done some incentive pay because facilities, their staff literally have come in day and night, and we want to reward them in some way. And so we have a number that have given what they term incentive pay, thank you pay, gratitude pay, you know, maybe $1 an hour for what you worked the last quarter. So it's helped immensely. So we're really hoping now the state of North Dakota will not offset that money we get and in essence take it away and not be able to benefit from it.
There is going to be a line, though, for budget negotiations, because the state is looking at trimming virtually every public agency's budget because of revenue shortfalls. And so there is going to be demand, and you're going to be, you know, part of the decision-making process there. But in the meantime, the average cost for long-term care in North Dakota is $10,000 a month or more. So let's talk about long-term policies here. What is the solution for literally liquidating somebody's assets in their last few years of their life?
Right. Well, to clarify what the average cost is, the average cost was $280 on average going into the pandemic. It's probably $290, $295. I haven't gotten the 2020 figures, but last year it was running at $280 a day. And when we looked at why does it cost $280 a day, there's one key factor on why it costs $280 a day, and that's because 75 to 80% of all that $280 a day is for staffing. It's for our 24-hour staffing. It's for our nurses, our CNAs, our dietary, our maintenance. So it's for our staffing. When we look at our staffing versus South Dakota as an example, we're much higher in staffing. And then what we look at is, does that high staffing, and when we look at it as an example, we have one CNA taking care of 6 residents. In other states, it might be one CNA taking care of 10 to 12 residents. That ratio of staffing is so important for quality of care and quality of life and making sure residents get the care they need. So 75 to 80% of all the money, all the daily rate goes into the staffing. Then the rest of it is maintenance of the building, the food, the medical supplies, those types of things to keep the building operational. But the vast majority is our staffing.
I think the issue here is, where do we go? I'll give you just one story. It's my own. My mother was in a nursing home for 5 years. She passed away years ago.
Yep.
In 5 years, she went through all of the money she and my father had saved all of their lives. What do we do as a nation to deal with what is inevitable? Our population is aging. I'm aging.
You know, Doug, that is a great question, and one that we as a state and one that we as a country need to decide, because we are all aging and we don't have the younger population coming up for our tax base that we've had. And we've all had fewer children. Very few are purchasing long-term care insurance. You know, that was a good viable option. I have long-term care insurance. I have a 4-year policy, and it really is a great protection in my mind to know that should something happen to me tomorrow, I have a policy that will pay for my long-term care. But we're seeing more, and we have a lot of North Dakotans that have long-term care insurance, and we continue to advocate for it, because if you want to protect your money, if something happens to you, what are you going to do? And that's why Medicaid is going up and up and up, because people are running out of money, or people don't have sufficient assets. But the expectation is when you get old and when you need care, you need to plan for it and you need to budget for it. And families in North Dakota do a tremendous job. We see years of families taking care of families, but there comes a point when they simply can't do it, and then they reach out to facilities. But that's a great policy question. How are we going to pay for our long-term care in the future? Can people look at insurance as a viable option? Sometimes it's like, well, you know, I have other priorities for my budget, so I don't know. And some people don't think I'm ever going to need long-term care, so they're not looking at it until we get old and we need it. And then it's too late.
Well, the complication there, Shelley, is also that they're paying medical insurance, and then you add long-term care insurance to that, and it could be bigger than your mortgage by far.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and even just think, that's a great, great point. Think if none of us had health insurance. If we didn't have health insurance and we ended up having a hospitalization or even just going to the clinic. I recently broke my foot, and my surgery and my x-rays, my surgery alone was $20,000. So had I not had insurance, I would have been coming up with $20,000 to have that operation. And I needed it, or I would have been physically impacted the rest of my life, not being able to be mobile. So so we've looked at as insurance as a mechanism to pay for our health care. For our long-term care, should we really be looking at the same thing, insurance, to help insure all of us that may need care as we get older? Just as those that don't have health insurance, it will financially devastate you when you need care. The same thing with long-term care. When you need it, if you don't have insurance, how are we going to pay for it?
Shelley, we have to end it there. We're just out of time, but that's a conundrum for the next time we chat.
It is. It is.
Shelley Peterson is president of the North Dakota Long-Term Care Association. Thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much, Doug. I look forward to future discussions on this important topic.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Tri-Valley Opportunity Council, offering the Foster Grandparent Program, a volunteer opportunity for older adults to assist kids with exceptional or special needs to be more successful in school. Volunteers are needed. Learn more at tvoc.org.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Blood banks are vital to supply the products needed for many life-saving medical treatments.
However, the pandemic has disrupted blood donations. At the same time, research has shown that people who have been infected with COVID-19 and recovered may be donors for convalescent plasma that could help others hospitalized by the disease. Last Tuesday, we talked about the nation's blood supply with Cliff Newmark, Chief of Marketing for Vitalant Blood Services.
Vitalant is a national blood bank which collects blood throughout the country, including North Dakota, the second largest in the country, actually. And we, every day, what our team members do in concert with the incredible generosity of the public and donors is ask folks to give blood so they can help a hospital patient in need. And that's definitely challenging at this time.
Well, you have those offices in Fargo, Bismarck, and Minot in North Dakota, so we're aware of that business here. Just for those people who may not be aware of blood donations and what blood is used for, just give us a quick overview.
Sure. Blood is used for a number of medical procedures. It could be a trauma if someone suffers from a major auto accident. It could be for treatments and therapies associated with cancer for cancer patients. And it could be for everyday hospital procedures such as hip replacements or knee replacements, or even for those individuals who have particular diseases like those who have sickle cell anemia, which impacts about 100,000 African-Americans throughout the country, require regular transfusions about every month in order to live. So blood is a part of many patients' care.
How has the pandemic affected donations?
Yeah, the pandemic has had a very significant impact on blood donations overall because the source of most blood in this country is from community organizations, high schools, colleges, businesses, places of worship. And especially during the stay-at-home orders, those organizations were not open. And consequently, we had to reach out directly to donors to show up at our blood donation centers or those limited number of places that were open. And that's our biggest challenge right now, is we're asking people to show up to our blood donation centers or alternatively to organize blood drives if they have folks at their location to give the gift of life. That's what hospital patients need today.
Well, let's talk about the chief of marketing. You're not trying to sell somebody something. You're trying to encourage them to give something. So how are you reaching people given this obstacle?
A couple of things that we're doing. First, we are reaching out to these organizations that normally organize blood drives. And to the extent that folks can't organize a blood drive at their site, we're asking them to encourage their community, their members of their church or place of worship, the members of their school or college or business, to actually sign up to give at the other places that are open, such as our blood donation centers. Another thing that we did is we launched a national campaign, Because of You, Life Doesn't Stop, because literally those individuals in the hospital can't live without a blood donor who provides them with that necessary life-saving blood. And then the other thing we did recently is we actually, to help let donors know about what's happening with them, we actually started testing every single blood donation for antibodies, the COVID-19 antibodies. We don't want people to show up to give blood if they're sick, but if they've recovered from the virus, they should have antibodies in them. And then we are testing for all blood donations for that. So these are some of the ways we're trying to reach out to folks in addition to the more traditional ways of reaching out via email and contacting folks and things like that.
Given that the pandemic made people a bit leery of healthcare centers in general because they didn't want to go where somebody had been that might have had the infection, what do you do to ensure that where they would be giving blood at Vitalant's blood banks or whatever would be, you know, safe? How do you market that? How do you market the safety of the operation?
So we've taken a number of steps to change how we conduct our blood drives or blood donation opportunities. So first of all, this has not changed. As we tell people consistently, you should only donate blood if you are well. If you're not well, for the safety of you and the safety of the staff and the safety of ultimately the hospital patients, we don't want you to give. Wait until you're better, then come in and give. We are taking temperatures at the door. We require staff and donors to wear face masks. We've spread out the chairs so that there is more distance between folks when they're actually giving blood, disinfecting services. We've taken a lot of those steps and put this in our information that we're communicating to donors to try to assure them that we're trying to make the environment as safe as we can.
Well, given that there is a pandemic, given that you're concerned about getting your normal volume of blood donations, where's the need right now? What are you short of, or is there a critical problem?
Yeah, the most important need right now is actually red blood cells, which is our standard blood donation product. When people think about giving blood, it's typically a red blood cell donation that they're giving. That's the piece that we need the most of. All blood types are needed. All blood types are needed. There's always an especial need for O negative blood, which is the universal blood donor that can go to anyone, irrespective of the patient's blood type. But red blood cells is the product that we need the most.
You mentioned that you're testing people to see if they have the antibodies in their system, indicating they would have been exposed to the virus. Is this a particularly valuable product potentially?
So we don't know a lot about this disease. For example, if someone has the antibodies, we believe that you create antibodies in order to fight infections. So we believe that the antibodies help, but it hasn't been proven yet that having antibodies in your blood will stave off infection in the future, potentially limit the time of infection. That's more of the science needs to prove that. But if folks didn't know, if they felt that they were sick and weren't sure, didn't get tested, it's an opportunity for them to know that. And it may be, as the medical science improves, it may be helpful for us for our understanding of the disease and the degree to which people can adjust their behaviors because they've had the disease in the past. So we're learning more about it, and really that's what the antibody testing is doing, is providing information to the blood donors about what potentially happened to them.
But at this point, you're not actively looking for recruiting people who've had the virus?
Oh, thank you. Yes, so for those folks who have had the virus, that had a positive test for the virus or tested positive for antibodies, we need those folks to give what's called plasma. Convalescent plasma is what it's called. So their plasma can actually be used for a patient who's suffering today in the hospital from COVID-19. So that plasma from those folks who have the antibodies or who had a positive test, we need those folks to schedule a convalescent plasma donation. And they can go to our website at vitalant.org to take steps to make that happen. And they can really help a COVID patient in need. The science, again, also is not proven yet, but this tactic of using plasma from patients who've recovered has been used for over about 100 years since the Spanish flu as a way of helping those recover. There's a couple of studies that are intending to come out to show its efficacy, but at this point, it seems like a very good idea. The FDA has allowed this procedure to be used to help COVID patients in need.
So there is some usefulness for this right now, and there's more, I guess, research being put into it to find out whether or not it has a really specific and profound impact on the infection. Is it given to people who are hospitalized and at a certain condition? I know you're not a doctor, but what can you tell us about how this is used?
Yeah, I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, but yes, the way that this is, the utilization of this, it's evolving, and there's been lots of studies that are trying to determine this. There seems to be some indication that using the convalescent plasma earlier on in the treatment may be very helpful to the patient, and there's some thought that shortly after hospitalization is when it could potentially be used. But it could be, you know, the conversations have been that as many as one out of every two hospitalized patients could use convalescent plasma.
Cliff Newmark is chief of marketing for Vitalant. That's a national community blood service provider. And we're talking about giving blood, the importance of it, the complications the pandemic has created, and whether or not there are particular blood products that might be particularly useful against COVID-19. Vitalant is looking for people that have antibodies present in their plasma. Are doctors in hospitals informing recovering patients about the potential for them to help others?
Yeah, so we're working with a number of organizations throughout the country, and we've had outreach to public health departments throughout the country to ask them to inform those who thankfully have recovered from the disease that an opportunity for them to help others is to actually give convalescent plasma. And that's frankly one of the other major reasons why we engaged in the antibody testing for all blood donations. By testing all blood donations for antibodies, we can potentially find folks who didn't even know they had the disease and basically let them know and then give them the opportunity to help a COVID-19 patient.
How often can donors give blood, or for that matter, plasma?
The typical regular blood donation is every 56 days. The plasma donation is typically every 28 days, but given the significant need, it can be up to every week with medical authorization by our blood bank physicians. And we've had some folks who've donated every week, and you have to be 28-day symptom-free from the disease to donate convalescent plasma. But we've had a handful of donors who have been donating every week since they had achieved that mark and were well and could donate.
Does Vitalant pay for donations? I know some plasma operations pay for plasma donations.
Yeah, Vitalant as a blood bank does not pay for blood donations. When you give blood or plasma to a blood bank, what you're giving is what's called a transfusible product. Literally, the fluid that comes out of a human being goes into another human being. The plasma centers that compensate actually take the plasma and distill it down to very targeted proteins that are then used in a kind of a pharmaceutical situation. So when people give blood, their fluids are going directly into someone else to help that patient in need.
So these are somewhat different products. You're not in competition then with plasma donor centers?
I don't believe we are. I think that folks who want to donate plasma should feel free to do so. We believe that we're offering our donors the ability to help literally save a patient's life. So that's why I think it's a little different procedure, and it's a different ask that we're making of our blood donors.
We talked briefly about your role as chief of marketing, getting the word out there for the need, and there is a need, always a need, and especially now. But what's the part about convincing people who might be a bit squeamish to have a needle stuck in their arm?
Now, so what we typically say is it's like a pinch. It really feels like a pinch, and it isn't a pinch and an hour of your time worth helping save someone's life. There are lots of folks who have had to overcome the squeamishness. But when you think about the outcome, which is really giving life to someone who needs it, it's a really compelling opportunity. And that's what we try to communicate to our blood donors.
The other thing that's changed a bit, I have given blood and had my blood tested on many, many occasions for other reasons. And I have to say phlebotomists are pretty skilled these days and the needles are pretty small.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we've tried to make the blood donation procedure as quote unquote painless as possible in all senses of the word. We have a program, a fast track that enables folks to answer the questions that we ask all blood donors in advance, so you can potentially shorten the amount of time you spend in the blood donation procedure. We've taken a look at other things like, for example, power red devices where you can actually give even more units in a safe way, so you can actually save more lives in one sitting. So there's a variety of different strategies and tactics we've used, including the training of our staff, to try to engage folks and enable them to save as many lives as possible.
I have a very good friend who's a Vietnam vet who has been giving blood for decades and has a pin for literally the gallons he's given. How many people in a country of, say, 350 million would qualify, roughly, to be able to donate blood?
Yeah, about 40% of the overall population can give. That includes, obviously, young people, those who are young teenagers, et cetera. If you look at all the adults, 17, 18 and above, the percentage of the population is almost about 60%. So still, the majority of people can, in fact, donate, even though only about 3% of the population in any given year donates overall. So there is a lot of opportunity to reach out to folks who can really help make a difference in someone's life.
What's the shelf life of a blood product?
So it does depend on the product. Red blood cells are 42 days. Platelets, they only last about 5 days. So platelets is a specialized procedure we do where we only draw the platelet products, which are used typically to stop bleeding. And they're often used in concert with chemotherapy and other cancer treatments. So platelets are only a 5-day product. So if we have to collect platelets every single day, basically the plasma that we collect, we usually freeze that product. And so that lasts about a year. But various products have different shelf lives. The bottom line, though, is we have to collect every single day.
Red blood, platelets, plasma, and then different types of blood and negative and positive and all of that. So give us a sense of how all the traffic is directed when you're dealing with blood banks that have 1,000 outlets and people in need all across the country. What kind of traffic direction is there to make sure the right product gets to the right place?
Yeah, it's a very complicated logistics operation. And so the good news about Vitalant, because we are a national blood organization, we can provide product all over the country, trying to take care of local needs. But sometimes things may happen. There's a snowstorm. You know, we can't get flights out of a particular area, what have you. And so we're able to move product around the country. And the product does vary, right? As you pointed out, it could be platelets, which is a short shelf life product. It could be O negative products. So we have to be thoughtful about how we stock our individual distribution centers. We work closely with our hospital partners regarding their utilization. It is a very complicated logistics operation.
Cliff Newmark is the chief of marketing for Vitalant. That is a nationwide community blood service provider. He's also previously been a senior vice president of the Red Cross, former CEO of the American Red Cross Southern California Blood Services. So, Cliff, how did you get into this? What drew you to blood services?
In my early on in my career, I had worked as a reporter, actually. I worked in government and in business consulting. And I had always thought that my calling would be to try to help others in need. That may sound a little trite, but I really did want to try to make a difference for folks. And so when I heard about an opportunity through a friend to be able to reach out and help motivate folks to give blood, I was like, wow, that sounds like a really challenging but really worthwhile thing to do. And so I started that journey in 2003 and was a senior vice president of the American Red Cross, where I was responsible for all the blood collected in the country, and then joined Vitalant about 6 months ago. We're working on other really interesting ideas to try to motivate folks to give. And it's been a very satisfying field and endeavor.
When I Googled your name, I came across a notice about something called YPO. And I had to Google that to find out what it was, because it wouldn't tell me on the site. But that's Young President's Organization. And you're a member of that, or you've been a member?
Yes, I'm a member of the Young President's Organization, although when you hit the age of 50, you go into what's called Young President's Organization Gold, because I'm not sure over 50 counts as old, anyway, young anymore. But in any event, yes, YPO is a fantastic organization. It's an organization, worldwide organization, that works for folks who are presidents or executives that lead organizations. It's been tremendously helpful for me because I was able to leverage fantastic learnings from those who work in their own family-owned businesses or those who work in major corporations, leading them to try to figure out ways to be the best we can in our enterprise, a not-for-profit enterprise that really tries to help people. And so it's been a great learning for me.
Do you give blood?
You know, unfortunately, Doug, I am one of those folks. When I said that only about 60% of folks are eligible to give, I'm one of the folks who cannot give because of some of the very specific restrictions. So, for example, if you've traveled to parts of the world where there was malaria, you can't give for a year because there's no test for malaria. I lived in England when I was in graduate school. And between 1980 and 1996, I lived there in the early 90s, and anyone who lived in England for more than 3 months between 1980 and 1996 cannot give because of the concern about the human variant of mad cow disease. So I try to make up for it by motivating others to give.
I found that interesting as well. I was looking at some of those determinants for who could give and who couldn't. I've been to a malaria area in the last year or so, so I have to wait for a while. I didn't realize that was a limitation. But it suggests that there maybe is more research that needs to be done into how you can find these various properties in blood and therefore not limit people.
That's correct. Yeah, the research is constantly evolving. And in fact, the FDA has changed their guidance over the years, both in incorporating restrictions, for example, when Zika came out, and in other cases, in changing restrictions, such as malaria, for example. So the science is constantly changing, and good science is necessary to ensure that we have the safety of our patients in mind. We try to do everything we can to ensure the safety of the blood supply so that folks in the hospital have safe products.
Just to touch once again on the pandemic that's underway and the issues that it raises for what you do, COVID-19, there is no pending cure. There is no vaccine that's readily available yet, and there are concerns about when either of those things might be possible. So this convalescent plasma treatment is somewhat encouraging to hear about. But is the blood supply in danger now because of the difficulty getting it and maybe motivating people to give it?
So this is the most challenging time that I've seen in the 17 years that I've been working with blood banks. When the pandemic first struck, we sounded the alarm, which was picked up by a number of organizations and the federal government, the Surgeon General, the CDC, FEMA. What we saw, thousands of blood drives canceled as a consequence, 6,800 blood drives canceled, which represented 175,000 pints of blood. And by talent alone, that's what we collect in basically a month and a half. All those organizations canceled their blood drives because of the stay-at-home orders. Thankfully, based on the government response, we were able to bring folks back to our blood donation centers and other places that were still open. Blood donation is an essential activity. And then we started getting very, very short on supplies, again, because not a lot of organizations were opening. And then we had folks respond when we said that we were testing all blood donations for antibodies. So this is right now we have a critical shortage of blood. We have about a 2-day supply of our old blood, and it is something extremely challenging. It was even worse 2 weeks ago. It's gotten a little better over the past couple of weeks, but still very, very, very challenging. And to be completely frank, we are very concerned about the future of our ability to meet patient needs, given the impact that the pandemic is having on physical places where people gather, high schools, colleges, businesses, places of worship, to the degree to which they are not having folks there or having fewer folks in those locations, that seriously changes how we have typically collected blood. And so we are working with those organizations to continue to stay engaged, to continue to reach out to their constituencies, to, if they can't have a blood drive on their campus or location, to actually encourage their stakeholders to donate at our blood donation centers. Those are all the steps that we need to take to ensure hospitals have what they need. And it is going to be very significant in terms of our ability to meet hospital needs, given how society is changing in this very significant way for good reason to try to keep people safe.
Cliff Newmark is chief of marketing for Vitalant, a national community blood service provider. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today, Cliff.
It's a pleasure, Doug. Thank you so much.
Coming soon from Safe Space Radio, a special program for Mental Health Awareness Month. Many white parents don't know how to talk to their kids about race and racism.
There are an awful lot of white people who I think are well-intended, who fundamentally do think that it's racist to even notice race.
Join us for stories about when and how to talk to white kids of all ages. Talking to White Kids About Race and Racism, a new program for Mental Health Awareness Month from Safe Space Radio.
Talking to White Kids About Race and Racism, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up this afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.